Hi, everybody. My name is Chris Dugan, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety day is July 21st of 1988. I have a home group and a sponsor, and I'm grateful to be here. Thanks, Billy, for inviting me down. It's a great drive, and I stand before you a grateful alcoholic, and I can't imagine having said that when I was first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll kind of cover right to the chase. This summer it'll be 20 years, and that might not be necessarily impressive to some of you, nor should it be, but it impresses me. And right off the bat, I got to tell you, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous sort of the old-fashioned way. My mom dropped me off and didn't come back to pick me up. I wish that I had a really exciting tale of being chased and run around the court systems and some of our exciting stories. But mine isn't necessarily that exciting. But what I can tell you is that when I drank, I would lose the ability to control my drinking once I started. If I think about it long enough, it kind of gives me cold chills. I have a profound respect for alcohol, and that isn't to say that that I'm terrified of getting struck drunk, and that's not why I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do remember exactly what alcohol did for me. And that was after about three drinks, it would make me feel inside exactly the way that I thought you felt. Certainly made me feel the way you looked. And so the nature of drinking for me was a love affair right from the start. My favorite booze was yours. My drink of choice was yours. And really, I didn't have too much of a choice on that. It was all that was around, But from the very beginning, I noticed a very dramatic change inside me. And I would like to say that physical phenomenon is what makes me an alcoholic, but alcohol physically will affect anybody. I mean, it's a sedative by nature, so anybody can drink. What makes me an alcoholic, and I say all this right up front, what makes me an alcoholic is 3 days after. And the book describes it as the insanity which precedes the first drink. It's that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontent. It's the reason why I wanted to blow my head off 6 months sober into this program. It's the reason why every time I've ever been suicidal, homicidal, or been just really intense for no particular reason at all, and most of the time that I got the question asked, what the hell's wrong with you? I was stone cold sober, so I didn't identify alcoholism as my problem. I identified sobriety as my problem. And it turns out that's the vicious cycle, and that's what's described throughout the big book as the insanity which precedes the first drink. And how it works, it's described, and I'll get started with my story, but in how it works, it's described. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. Now, those three pertinent ideas are really just our first three steps in fancy wording. Really, it takes us through a level of insanity, sort of the spin drive of what we go through. A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. One thing without the other is pretty meaningless. A, that we were alcoholic. If I'm an alcoholic and I can manage my life, I'm not going to be here. And if I can manage my life, my life's unmanageable, but I'm not an alcoholic, that means I belong in a loony bin, right? It needs to be managed for me. The two combined means I'm an alcoholic, and it means I'm still crazy, but I'm crazy with an official nice little title. And that goes on to the second idea, was that A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And so what that means is it references power, and the book talks about lack of power, that's our dilemma, and that no human power. That means as much as my mom and dad and as much as everybody kind of wanted me to be happy and people that love me and trust me, wanted me to do right, didn't matter. They could love me all they want. It still didn't matter. That love wasn't necessarily powerful enough to keep me from doing that. And I took a whole lot of actions which proved that as well. And that C, God could and would if he were sought. That esoteric G word. And so that God word, that God could and would if he were sought. And that implies a journey. And so that C part is why I stand before you. So that's really an hour talk, and you can pretty much, that's an hour talk for about 4.5 minutes. But that's why I'm standing before you. And I'll start back from way at the beginning. You know, I looked around in the sixth grade, and I'm going to start the year I started drinking, because I remember it very well. And I was in the sixth grade, and I had a sixth grade teacher. Her name was Mrs. Bearn. She's probably dead now, at least I hope she is. Actually, I don't mean that in a resentful way. I hope she's not suffering. I hope she's not, you know what I mean. Well, anyway, this crazy, nice school teacher, well-intentioned, she used to give out stickers every Friday if you did your homework all week. Give out these little stickers. Now, what does this have to do with drinking and not drinking, living and dying? Well, I'm about to get to that. I couldn't get a sticker. In fact, right about my sixth grade year, they started testing for these learning disabilities, right? Big deal up in Northern Virginia. Oh, we got to test all the kids for these learning disabilities. And they just started throwing in all these tests, right? It seemed like every other week I was filling out. I mean, probably before I could even spell my name, I'm filling out little circles. This is a circle. This is a square. This is a triangle. Well, sixth grade, there I am. I'm seeing if I know how to read. Turns out I don't. Go figure. And I'm supposed to be at this level, introduce the idea, the whole ability, potential, right? And what lives in here, they would say, is opportunity. But I would argue that what lives in here is very low self-esteem. So you've got this ability and potential thing, right? Oh, you have so much potential, but your ability's down here. So I start going, and what do you do with a sixth grader who's, doesn't know how to do all that stuff? You put them in special ed, which I referred to as the retarded school. And so they would send me every day. They would extract me from that class for about 2.5 hours. So all the other kids, they weren't having to go to the special class. I was going to the special class. Well, I was born with yellow teeth, right? Terrible, terrible thing. Awful. No enamel on my teeth, which means they're ultra sensitive. And if you're familiar with it, it's enamel hypoplasia. It just means you look like your teeth are falling out. And by the time I'm in the sixth grade and your teeth look like you're falling out, kids are cruel. So there I am with yellow teeth, which is going to stress me out. So I have ulcers, right? Totally stressing me out because I got to go to this special class and I've got yellow teeth. So that's going to give me ulcers. So there I am. And so I suddenly start developing this repertoire of people I know with ologist at the end of their names. So by the time I'm in the sixth grade, I have a urologist, right? I have a psychologist. I have a speech pathologist. I have all these ologists, right? All these ologists. And it stressed me out. It turns out I don't even know how to take a crap because I have all these hemorrhoids. So I've got a proctologist. Now, you look around the sixth grade. I've got a proctologist, an endodontist, a urologist, all the ologists, psychologists, because it's starting to make me a little kooky. I'm in the sixth grade. Now, this is Mrs. Bearn was not understanding at all. And she still wouldn't give me the damn sticker on Fridays. Oh, yeah. Yeah. God rest your soul. Jerk. Anyway. I'll tell you what. Now, lots of money going out the door. Insurance is paying for all this, or at least some of it. My mom's kind of stressing out. And anyway, another interesting thing happened in sixth grade. My dad, he would just, fall over dead. Every once in a while, he would just, have a heart attack and die. So, and it turns out he had, this congestive heart failure thing going on. So, and he's diabetic, and it turns out he used to drink before I was born, and he still smoked cigarettes, and, it's this thing he's not supposed to smoke, but he would, walk the dog all the time and come home in the middle of winter with all the windows open in his car. So, I mean, he's smoking and falling down, which I didn't care. I used to steal his cigarettes, actually, at the time. So I got all this stuff going on, and I'm doing all this observation, and I'm feeling different. The reason why I'm feeling different is, you know what, guys? I was different. I was that kid who's sitting on the little inflatable donut with, weird teeth painting going on, having to eat these handfuls of God knows what, while I'm walking on my way to the special school, which was on the other side, and everybody would see me. I was different. I was different by very nature. And so there I was. And it turns out I didn't need any of those ologists. So I didn't even need the dentist, really. All I needed was a highball of Tanqueray. That was my first drink. I'll tell you what. You don't think I remember what exactly that did for me? I remember exactly what my first drink did for me. I would turn my head and all that stuff that was going on and all the itchy and people being nice. It seemed like just people would be nice to me and it would just annoy me. People that were nice to me used to annoy me. My mom, she was so sweet. She would be nice to me and just annoy me until I started drinking. And after I'd hit that and it would hit my belly and it would feel all warm and I, what it tastes like really didn't matter. I just remember after about 3 drinks I turned my head and everything would just, everything would focus very quick. And I was just constantly thinking until about that 3rd drink and then all of a sudden it would be, right from the very start. Can you imagine? I can't imagine a 6th grader. I can't. I tell the story, I stand before you, and this is my story, but I have a 3.5-year-old now. And some of the kids in the neighborhood, these are 6th graders coming over to my house. I mean, they're like this. I can't imagine. But I remember as if I was in this size body and this mentality with this broken head. And I remember exactly what the first drink did for me. It's so funny how the brain works. It really is. It's so interesting. Bill talks about it throughout the book is, kind of a twofold disease, a mental and sort of a physical and sort of a spiritual. We have a physical allergy of the body, right? An obsession going on, of the mind. The body and mind kind of working together against us. I remember exactly how that came together, but I thought that's how everybody experienced their first drink. I thought that's how everybody experienced their drink. If you watch TV, it looks like it. Nightcap, watching Love Boat. Let's go get a nightcap. And they'd all get all mellow. And I'd go and I'd get all mellow. And I was stealing Tanqueray from the 6th grade. So growing up, I didn't recognize anything was wrong with that. From the first time I drank, I developed a tolerance reasonably quick. I could drink a whole lot in a short amount of time without a whole lot of negative consequences, to the point where I would actually either lose control or stop caring about what I was taking in. And my body would, anybody is going to reject it. Anybody is going to get to a point where they're going to become toxic on alcohol. And when my body did it, it was, you guys would have hated to drink with me for sure. Because it was lame. Because I would black out reasonably soon, especially towards the end of my drinking. And I would vomit nonstop. And I wouldn't just vomit like a gentleman vomit. Kind of that cough vomit. I would do the screaming vomit. I was a screamer. I would do the screaming at the. I remember every once in a while I'd come out of this grayout and I'd be holding the commode and scream, and I could see the vibrations on the water from my screams, and nothing was coming out. And the reason is that I would wake up. Now here's an interesting thing: is I would wake up the next morning and I would not have any hangover whatsoever. Weird thing there. I've never actually had a really bad hangover as a direct result of drinking. I don't know what that's about. Some people have that, some people don't. But I think my body just ate up all that acetaldehyde and the central nervous system. Like, oh yeah, no, don't. That's not waste. Hold on to that. Because it never really gave me long-term bad effects. I might have felt a little bit nauseous in the morning, but and maybe still a little bit spinny from being, I guess, still drunk, evidently. But the point is that once I started drinking, I would lose the ability to take what I was taking in. And it would work for a few days, actually. One day was when it would set me right. It would set me right. My parents started getting worried about me. In fact, right about the time I started drinking and a couple years into it, my sister wound up, she was in high school, she's older than me. She was in high school and about her senior year. And it turns out, I just thought she was just kind of a bitch. And it turns out she had like this PCP vodka thing going on, where she like had a ton of vodka. She always used to carry these Sprite bottles, and she had this PCP thing going on too, which meant she was really trippy in terms of her mood changes. Sober, she was just kind of really crazy, and then drunk, she was kind of cool. So I never knew what to judge. Well, it turns out she got busted for the whole thing, and so she winds up in rehab, right? So my sister goes to rehab, she gets out. It's a big family thing. So there I am with all the ologists, and by now I'm starting to drink, and so my mom starts towing me off to Alateen, where they start pumping me full of information. I mean, it was cool information, whatever. But she's like, somehow we went from reading Charlotte's Web as my first books to... there was this, the new medical model was fresh fresh on the shelf with a book called Under the Influence. And so she's reading me chapter and verse of Under the Influence. See, you have an 80% chance. See, look, your sister and your father and, you know, your grandfather, and he died. And so suddenly I start getting the whole family history, right? It didn't change anything because I didn't recognize early on that I had a problem with alcohol. I had a problem with staying sober. But I didn't have a problem with drinking. I could drink fine. So next thing I know, my sister's out of rehab, and then there's my dad, like, detoxing on the couch. And I'm like, what's up with this? And my mom's like, well, remember that time Dad drove out to West Virginia and never came home, and they found him in a hotel room 3 days later? I was like, yeah. She's like, that's not normal. I said, really? She started going through all these things and putting these things together. And so it turns out she was mad at our family doctor for pumping him full of prescriptions. So my dad had this, like, this pill thing. Next thing I know, he's flopping around on the couch and sweating bullets and having heart attacks again, and it's going crazy. My sister's, you know, going to rehab, and I'm going to Alateen, me in between dentist appointments. So then all of a sudden, like, this family awareness for alcohol. So there's no drinking going on, and I'm losing my mind. The longer I'm kind of in this little sober environment, the worse it gets. So now I have this new shrink, Dr. Clam, who's this guy. He was an interesting man, but he was to change the course of my history for sure. He spotted me right off. He knew it right off. I think he's the reason why I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm certain of it, actually. He was able to identify, when I was 13 and a half, he was able to identify acute alcoholism, although it would have been absurd to put that as a diagnosis at the time. I mean, even then, that would have been slightly absurd, but all the same, a lot of our topics and a lot of our conversations centered around the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. In hindsight, I remember this. Now, whether or not he is a professional 12-stepper, I don't know, but he was one person who I could be honest with. In fact, he got me a job not too far from here over in Orkney Springs, Virginia, working for the Diocese of Virginia, the Episcopal Diocese. And I was lifeguard counselor, or I was like a lifeguard for the local pools there. It was a great connection because all the dishwashers were just drunks. I mean, they would be washing dishes completely wasted. So it was a great connection. I lived in this place called The Hut. There's just unlimited supply. And so it turns out that it was sort of a controlled environment that he knew there was drinking going on, but he figured it was probably safer than where I was. So he urged my parents to send me there. He suddenly became my hero. I'm like, yeah. So I have this unlimited supply. Meanwhile, he's got like all these spies watching me. Well, it turns out after a couple of summers of doing that, I was honest with a couple of people. And it turns out, you know, when I would go home for the winter, I would end up having to care for my dad and helping my mom out and stuff. And I would just lose my mind. In fact, I would just go into these severe depressions. And that's what long-term sobriety brought me, was just severe depressions when I tried it on my own. My parents got a little worried, and they wanted me to start hanging out with my brother a little bit. And he was dating a girl from Winchester, and they were into hunting, right? So my parents, probably not going to make this mistake with my children, but my parents bought me this 12-gauge shotgun, right? Yeah, bad idea. Bad idea. Now, this is pre-Columbine or any of those bad ideas that are in the paper. But meanwhile, I have this 12-gauge shotgun, and I'm prone to misery and depression and being upset. And I knew exactly what a double-out buckshot would do. I certainly knew what it did to a lot of trees and small, innocent birds that would, you know, unfortunately land in front of me. And I was just kind of a weird kid when I'd stay sober and didn't have anything to sort of... I just constantly was running kind of a court low, permanently. So I became very, very suicidal. Well, I remember this one day, just one particular day, I literally lost my mind. Chaos becomes a very, very comfortable place. Terror. I was afraid of pretty much everything, and I remember staring down the barrel of that shotgun, toe on the trigger with every intention to blow my head off. You guys, I didn't have 1 ounce of anything on board, except for I used to keep some butane and speed pills under my bed, but that was, you know, who didn't? But you know, other than a little bit of that, just because it was reasonably easy to get. Other than that, you know, I honestly can't tell you why I wasn't successful in that, because I remember exactly what it felt like to be at the pinnacle of despair. There was nothing going on. I mean, I would love to tell you that my life was a sham and, you know, I was getting abused at home or, you know, all that. But the fact is just my brain was just very, very unfriendly territory. All the problems that I had in my life, again, in hindsight, I created. I made them. There was no difference between me and the kid down the street. I mean, for the most part. It just seemed to me that everything just felt, you know, what was a little itchy to you felt excruciatingly painful to me. What made you a little annoyed made me rageful. It's just constantly up and down and up and down. And so, you know, people, I've had a bunch of people that I've sponsored through the years or people that I've worked with or known and loved who've been successful at that, who've been successful at suicide and all that and successful in homicide. And, you know, it's a horrific, horrific disease we have. That comes with it a whole lot of baggage. And I would never judge those individuals, ever. Ever, ever, ever. And that's what I mean by that profound respect for this program. Because what's interesting is, you know, after I've been here a while, I haven't thought like that or experienced that that level of terror in a long time. You know, but after a couple of summers of, you know, horsing around like I did, turns out I started getting in trouble from that, from being a screamer. It just turns out the neighbors aren't too keen to that. In fact, my neighbor was the local priest who happened to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he would come over and he would say, "Chris, if you don't stop, you're going to kill yourself." So, and he would assign somebody. He would just walk in. He didn't bust us ever. He just didn't. He just seemed to come in and know exactly what was going on. Okay, he's the alcoholic. That's not the alcoholic. You have to watch him, make sure he doesn't choke on his vomit, and have him come see me tomorrow at 10. And this happened like 3 or 4 times, right? And I'd come clean with something, and we'd do this thing, and he'd pat me on the head and say, "Let me know when you're ready." And I knew what was on the back end. He drove this, I remember, it was right when caravans first came out. He had this circle and triangle on his caravan. And so, Roger... was very patient and finally said, "All right, let me know when you're ready." And finally one day, I said, "I'm ready." Next thing I know, that Dr. Clam shows up, and then I'm on my way home. They fired me from there. As soon as I said I was ready, I got fired. What is that? I mean, I hadn't drank in like a couple of days, and that was July 21st of 1988. Well, next thing I know, I'm at home, and nobody's really talking to me, and my mom and I are on our way to the dentist, of course, and she goes off with the dentist, and the dentist comes back, and he's got kind of a tear in his eye. And he's kind of shaking his head, and he goes to work on me again. And we were doing some sort of crown work or something. I had my grill replaced like 3 or 4 times, and I think he was just doing some touch-up work. And he's like really taking his time. He's got this tear. I'm like, "What's up, doc?" And he's like, "Guy has to have some dignity." And I thought, that's a little bit strange. Next thing I know, we get in the car, and the bags are packed in the back seat, and we're on our way. From there, I went to Arlington Hospital, and I'm playing ping pong with a 350-pound guy that has got all kinds of burn marks on his arm. He's a lot bigger than me. He let me know right away that he was a black belt in one of the martial arts. I don't remember which one. I just remember thinking, I better let this guy win at ping pong, and will they let me smoke here? And I wound up in rehab, spin dry, for 6 weeks. And that particular rehab happened to be centered around at least some of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and some of those familiar books, that Alateen. Turns out I started going to meetings on the other side, not necessarily on the teen side, but on the, there I am, you know, barely 16 years old, sitting in a room full of people who had just amazing, amazing stories. You guys, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the first time I came in, because there I was, I'm drinking coffee, I'm smoking cigarettes. You guys are being way cool about giving me cigarettes. Like, bumming cigarettes was like nothing. As soon as I would put one out, somebody would slide over some more. I mean, I was smoking everything. It's great. It was awesome. I got marble lights. I mean, I literally would line them up in front of me with a couple of cups of coffee and a bunch of cookies, and then it's like, you know, let the games begin, because then the stories would come, right? And you're hearing about everything in meetings, from Vietnam stories to just crazy, crazy, you know, real people who like shot a lot of people and other people who like were shot a lot. I mean, just amazing stories. I mean, from all sides of all conflicts. And I mean, really, it's pretty interesting. And I loved it. I loved meetings. I felt right at home. Interesting thing is, something I identified is, I would sit in a meeting, and as presuming that I had enough cigarettes and enough coffee, I began to recognize something early on. And that was that feeling that I told you about when I first started drinking. It was at least that point where it was, and my hands would stop sweating a little bit, and something that was anxious and just sort of empty inside would at least fill up while I was in there listening to you. Because while I was listening to you and identifying in what you were saying, what was happening is I was out of myself. And I loved meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for that very reason. I remember this one meeting, Hagerstown used to do this conference, this Maryland conference, and I sat in this Alcathon for like 19 hours straight, just sitting in meetings, listening mostly, and just felt right at home. I did. I felt right at home. Here's what would happen though: is I would leave the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wouldn't necessarily feel at home again, and I would feel that. Kind of that restlessness, irritability, and discontent that the book describes. And I wasn't able to reconcile that, but I went to a lot of meetings early on. First 6 months, Sundays alone, we'd do 6 and 7 meetings a day. And I don't say that to say how I built up my resume in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I say is that I just happened to hang around people that did a lot of meetings. And meetings pretty much every day was the norm. And believe it or not, it still pretty much is the norm almost 20 years later. But the point is I found a group to hang out with that were doing this thing. And I came in with a lot of image. And there I was, you know, there was a ton of us in the 80s that came in. In fact, insurance companies, if you were busted for anything, I mean, if you were busted for smoking anything on the wall or around the corner or in the sewer or wherever kids are getting in trouble, it just seemed like insurance companies were just literally just shoveling us in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we took over some great, beautiful, wonderful meetings unknowingly, because we just didn't understand respect, and we didn't understand what the 12 steps, we didn't understand anything other than, it seemed more like a consequence, that Alcoholics Anonymous was a consequence other than a privilege. And there's two ways to look at it, and if it's a consequence, really, things happen like having to get court slips signed or having to check boxes on treatment plans. If it's a privilege, usually what happens is you find yourself really learning a lot about making coffee and setting up chairs. But for me, in at least my first 5 years of Alcoholics Anonymous and 5 years sober, this way of life was much more of a consequence. And so living in that consequence, you know, you have to have image. Because if you're in consequence, you have to have image to really stay alive. And I had lots of that. I was terrified of what you thought, to the point where I would change pretty much anything on my outsides so that you would believe my insides, something else was going on. In fact, back then, there was a ton of us, and it seemed like all the cool people that I wanted to hang out with that were having the most fun were hanging outside the meeting as opposed to inside the meeting. And so we coined the phrase parking lot sobriety, and that's what we were. We would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we actually wouldn't even step inside the meeting. We'd hang outside and pick up trucks and listen to cool tunes, and back then, fanny packs and spandex and tank tops and whatever else was kind of cool. And we'd sit outside and judge the people that were sitting inside the meeting. You know, kind of little character assassination parties. And there were more of us than there were of the people that were going in the meeting. There were more of us hanging outside the meeting than there were hanging inside the meeting. And one can only get away with that for so long. At least until that familiar old restlessness, irritability, and discontent comes up. Because something in me wasn't getting treated, and I thought it was. Because if I was having fun, then my disease is getting treated, right? If I'm laughing, then I'm not crying. And it turns out that's not true. Now, you guys were telling me that, but my friends were finding it out firsthand, and I'd get phone calls from my best buddies in our little parking lot sobriety group, said, "Hey, you mind if I start drinking? Would you still hang out with me?" And I didn't know what to say. These were my friends. This was really all I had left. I mean, I came from that crazy, crazy place. I didn't have a whole lot going on. I was reasonably antisocial, at least towards the end, so I didn't have anything left of the people I used to drink with. This is all I knew. And one by one, they're going away. Now, had I not been in a position where I was to get a sponsor while I was in that rehab, and had I not had the sponsor that I had, who happened to be in the meeting, who happened to be the guy that was making the coffee, who happened to be the guy that was setting up the chairs, which is now my home group, I'm not entirely sure I'd be your speaker tonight. He never told me anything. Not early on. He showed me. He was the guy that would drive out without any questions asked and pick me up. Now, I didn't recognize it at the time. Like, gosh, isn't that nice? He's getting totally other-centered, and he's driving 35 miles to pick me up. All I knew is, God, I've got to go to another meeting. Oh, what am I going to miss out on? I mean, I'm barely making it through high school. And, you know, as far as reading and all that stuff, I just stopped really caring about high school. I was much more into having fun than I was any of that. In fact, 2 weeks before my high school graduation, there were four or five of us that were sober together, or I guess dry around AA together. I called up my sort of sponsor, if that's what he was, and he was just a guy that would listen to me. And told him I wanted to quit school. He thought that was probably not a bad idea. Told him I'd wait a little. Turns out they let me graduate, just barely, but I graduated high school. And it was right around that time where I was just about done with AA. Because the image thing wasn't working. I could change my outsides all I wanted, but it wasn't changing how I was feeling on the inside. And I'm thinking of quitting school, and, you know, I'm like, what am I doing this for? And I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My friends, one by one, are drinking. Why don't I just kind of go with them? And by then, we were going to clubs, right? And we were going to bars because that's where, really, much more attractive people were hanging out. At least the people that were hanging out in the bars were much more attractive than the people that were walking in the meeting, at least from my eyes. And so I was going to chase what I was looking for. And if you had something I wanted, I was going to do what you did. And it just so happened, if you were going to the bar and you had something I wanted, I was going to follow you. So there I found myself in these bars and clubs. And the problem is, all the people that are successful in doing that scene are drinking. And so I was starting to get thirsty, and I didn't even know it. I was to experience pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, as they discussed, and nothing was going on. Every single problem in my life, yet again, I had created. I'm not a victim of anything. I'd created enough problems to the point where I started getting suicidal again in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys, I was going to meetings almost every day. Pretty much, I was going every day. And I was going to give it a fair shot, and it seemed like I started following this guy into the meeting, and one by one, my friends are getting drunk, and my life's actually getting worse. As soon as I make this resolve, all right, I'm going to give this AA thing a shot, all of a sudden, things start getting worse, and I'm like a year and change sober. And I'm watching kids around me, and guys around me, and girls around me getting sober, and their lives are getting better like that. It seemed like, you know, they'd come in off skid row, and all of a sudden they're like, find out, oh, I just inherited $2 million and my great uncle just left me all this, and now all of a sudden they're all these people seem like all this good fortune, and it did nothing except really piss me off. Getting envious. And things did get worse initially. Then one day I found myself swinging a mop, and I don't know what happened, but I mean, I was really intense, and you swing a mop, and I was paying attention to the floor, and really it was, you know, I remember kind of graduating from being able to swing the mop across 3 tiles, 1 foot tiles, to 5 foot tiles. Turns out I got pretty good at mopping, and it turns out I started feeling that thing again. That thing that I was describing when I would listen to the meetings and have enough cigarettes and enough coffee lined up. I was starting to feel that thing again, that as the mop was in my hand. And there I was, and it turns out I started showing up early with my sponsor, and we started an 11-step meeting, a meditation meeting. Before we would actually set up the meeting, it was really just a quiet time together. We'd read the 11-step, and I found it there. And then we'd go and make the coffee, and it would almost accelerate it even further. And I found what I'd found early on. Only this time, my sponsor was giving me some direction about working some steps. And I was to write my 4-step and be honest and do an honest 5th step. A couple of bad things that went on back, or I guess some really bad messages. They used to say, and I haven't heard it in a long time, but you know, you don't want to do your 4-step until your ass falls off, which is probably one of the craziest things I've ever heard. Ever. In hindsight, it was widely accepted back then. Don't do your 4-step until your ass falls off. Well, what happens if your ass falls off? I kept turning around, like, did it fall off? Did it fall off? Till one day I was so thirsty, I guess that's when my ass fell off, is what that scenario I described to you. But I tell you what, that scenario almost took me out. Almost took me out. So, it's my own personal experience that you don't wait till your ass falls off to do your 4-step. You do your 4-step after you finish your 3rd step, when your sponsor tells you. And that's really what came to pass. I did an honest 4th step and a 5th step. And there was some other crazy stuff. Burning the 5th step. Ceremonial burning and burying of the 5th step. You know, I had some skeletons in the closet and some things. You grew up in an alcoholic home. There's some weird stuff that goes on, and I was certainly guilty and I guess seemingly victimized as the next guy. But, you know, there's a ceremonial burning, and I was 100% honest. What I did is I just put my 8th step up in flames. So I was going to have to go back and write it. So I don't recommend you do that. I certainly wouldn't leave it out on the kitchen table for the passerby to pick it up. But that whole ceremonial burning thing and burying thing is pretty useless because it goes into that 8th step. But I was to walk through the steps and to graduate school. In fact, my sponsor had sent me to the airport because I let it leak out that I'd always wanted to fly airplanes. That was kind of a secret dream, and I thought that was sort of kind of beyond me, really. I mean, in order to fly airplanes, you got to be like one of those math people and be good at reading. I might scare you here a little bit, but you don't. You don't at all. Like anything, time with effort equals results in one direction or the other, but there will be some results as a result of in the equation of time and effort. And sure enough, found myself studying aviation and just fell in love with it. Fell in love with flying. And it was everything I thought. I mean, from the first flight till today, I still do it. As a matter of fact, that is my career, is a professional aviator and fly for an airline. I'm an airline captain. Can you believe that? It's crazy. It's crazy. It freaks me out to even hear myself say that. It freaks me out to say that I'm not, like, medicated and under constant surveillance. Really. I don't say it out of a place of ego. Please, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, look at me. I'm saying, look at this. What is that? What is that? I mean, you know, the hemorrhoid ulcer kid who couldn't read with yellow teeth and, like, through that, the wearing the wife beater fanny pack spandex, going to the clubs, trying to be cool, feeling like a turd in a punch bowl constantly. Like, you know, staring down the same barrel of a shotgun at a year and a half sober. Now I'm a professional aviator and I'm probably flying your family around. If you're not amazed, I am. It blows my mind. But the fact is you know, haven't had the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and having recognized the fact of what the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was, it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It did for me what drinking used to do. It became a substitute. If there's something wrong with that, it's news to me. There's only right with that. I've been afforded, because of the examples in my life, I've been afforded to be able to build Alcoholics Anonymous not only in my life but around my life. To be in the center, because I've fallen several times. I've gotten so big for my britches that But I started, you know, moving away. There's some of the great blessings, you know, it talks about it in the long form of the 12th tradition. This to the end, that our great blessings will never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. It's an ominous warning. Almost took Bill out. Almost took Bob out. Every alcoholic comes to pass. And as I said, time plus effort equals results. So it's not a matter of if it's going to get better. It really is a matter of when it's going to get better. And then the big question comes to pass, what did I come here for? What did I come to Alcoholics Anonymous for? And I've been tested with that question hundreds of times. You guys, I've flown presidents. I've flown vice presidents. I've flown senators around the country. It's very difficult to start really taking credit for your life and then go into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and then assign due credit. It's impossible. Because then all of a sudden, do I really need to be making coffee? I mean, I'm waiting for the man to beat me. I might have to leave. Somebody might need a transplant. I mean, I'm running transplant teams from huge universities in this area. Airports not too far from here, picking up transplant teams, going all over the country, delivering them back here. I'm an important guy to the point where I started feeling that crazy sensation, that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontent. What I'm saying is that I've almost been killed by the very gifts and the blessings that I've gotten in this program and as a direct result of taking actions in this program. And I hope that doesn't happen to me again. I see it time and again. But I understand. Not only do I understand the newcomers that are suicidal and homicidal, but I understand the people with time. And it's my observation that it's very easy to do subtraction in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's also my experience. It's very difficult to do that addition. Which is why that whole getting back to basics phenomenon, I don't say getting back to basics. My sponsor, that sponsor that was in mopping the floors and picking up chairs and staying busy, used to say, stay close to the vomit line. Stay close to the vomit line. And what he was talking about was, don't forget where you came from. And the surest way to not forget where you come from is when somebody puts their hands in your life, or puts their life in your hands. When somebody is new to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, has never been there before, and the difference of their make or break, whether or not they're going to go kill a family of four in a caravan down the road, or whether or not they're going to go destroy their lives, or they live a happy, sober life, could be my hand reaching out to them. I don't know what kind of power that is, and I can't imagine that it was anything other than divine something, that it would put a kid like me in that position where I might have the ability to make a difference like that. What I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for, I found. And what I found, I've wanted to stay for, and I want to hold on to it with everything I got. There's nothing I wouldn't do for this program. But I've forgotten what I've come here for. Or I've changed the definition, and that's what's almost taken me out. You know, I came here to feel better. And eventually I did feel better. And I had to change why I was here. It's a constant reassessment. I stay here now because I don't regret not drinking yesterday. I've never woken up a day sober and said, God, I wish I would have drank yesterday. I've never woken up saying that. You know, it's kind of funny. It was so close. It was. That parking lot sobriety thing, it really seemed like we were under the big top. It did. You get to see the animals come off. You get to see the clowns walk in. You get to see the tent go up. There's a lot of activity that goes on in this to make this thing happen. And from the outside looking in, that's entertaining enough. And it's very easy to think, I've been to a circus as I'm standing outside watching the big top go on. Might even be able to hear the music a little bit. Might even be able to hear what's going on. And I might have checked that box saying, yeah, I've been there. I tried AA. Didn't work. But I was just like the guy that pulls up, watch him set up the tent, and then go home, satisfied that I'd been to the circus. But no. This is the big top. You know, setting up those creamers, and setting up those stirrers, and setting up these chairs, and keeping good contact with the church and knowing what's going on with the pastor and making sure we don't leave our cigarette butts outside. That's the big talk. It has nothing to do with me. Nothing to do. That's all I want today. That's all I want. You know, it's kind of interesting. you know, at home we have I have a 3-year-old, 3.5-year-old. My wife is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, she spoke at this group before. She's sober and sponsors lots of women, and we have big books all over the coffee table, and our neighbors aren't entirely sure what to think. They trust us, but they don't know why they trust us. You know what I mean? Like, one day there's, like, crackheads on my porch smoking cigarettes, screaming in their cell phones, and the next day they're, like, helping me, you know, plant tulips and picking daisies, and we're reading books, and I got them out there praying, and they don't know what to think. You know, they just watch. They just watch. Started seeming with amused skepticism, but after a while it turns into a beautiful thing. And so some of my neighbors know. The people at my work don't know. You guys, I don't get on the PA and start announcing everything on who I am and what I've done. It's life and death that you know the truth about me. Is that I have an ego, which means that I am prone to separate me from the rest of the world. Anything that makes that separation. It's important that you know all the aspects of that, and that I'm just as capable of drinking as anybody. I'm not immune by any stretch of the imagination, that I suffer from a mental obsession. An obsession with an allergy of the body. Those two combine. It's a deadly combination. You know, but when my father was on his deathbed and he was dying, and he was taking his last breaths, we didn't waste the time with a bunch of "I'm sorry." Growing up in an alcoholic home, that's almost unfathomable to many, many people. When you grow up in an alcoholic home and you have two alcoholics, a father and a son, to not have to worry, not have to spend time wasting time saying a bunch of apologies. Our relationship was complete, and I'd already made those amends. I got to be there just as his son. I didn't have to be there as his counselor, as his judge, as his jury. I got to be there just as his son. And he passed, and our relationship's complete. Love him to death. Love him to death. I hope I can be as good of a father as he was. I wasn't saying that at the time. It's hard when you're a victim. It is. Today my life is my fault, and my sobriety is my responsibility. I don't take credit for my life, but anything that goes wrong in my life, chances are I've created it. When my mother passed away, we were buddies. I had the distinct honor of being her primary caregiver and watching her and kind of helping her into the final stages of life. And that's kind of an intense situation. I got to do for her everything she got to do for me when I was a little baby, really. And I saw it as a very, very great honor. One that I would never, ever take back. And we spent some great moments. And I wasn't there apologizing to her. I wasn't there running for the hills. I wasn't there, you know, explaining to her why I peed in the bush and killed the ficus tree again. I wasn't. I was there, you know, do you want some peaches? You want some toast? Want some juice? You know, they trusted me with this comfort pack. God, love, hospice. Love those people. She died. And our relationship was complete. The last thing she saw was her son, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, saying, "You are the best mom ever. Thank you so much for being my buddy, for being my mom." And she passed. Several years later, that guy who didn't judge me, who welcomed me into that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, who sponsored my sponsor, who was a man who wasn't saying, "Oh, isn't it great? You're so young. You've got your whole life ahead of you. You're sober now." He ultimately became my sponsor. My sponsor, the one who saved my life, moved away, and I had a sponsor who had a sponsor, and his name was Mike. And Mike was a guy who wasn't, you know, treating us like we were unicorns in Alcoholics Anonymous, as young people sometimes are, at least back then, prone to be treated like, "Wow, you're one of those young people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's great you got here so early." He wasn't saying that at all. What he was saying is, get your ass to work. Your life is your fault, and your sobriety is your responsibility. Now get in there. I'm telling you right now, at the time, that didn't seem like a very nice, gentle message. But as I'm swinging that mop between 3 and 5 tiles, I grew to appreciate that man and exactly what he did. And I got to help him in his final stages of life. And it was truly my honor to be there with some of my AA brothers, where we were takers and barely graduated high school, only thinking about what we could take from that. Really, helping that guy in any way possible. We would do anything for him. Take him to radiation. Change diapers. Anything. Anything. And it was of my greatest life honor. And he let us. That was the cool part. I always felt nervous talking to my sponsor, talking to Mike. I always felt a little bit nervous. And Mike did eventually pass, and the last thing he heard was there were three of us. He had his fiance and a couple other my AA brothers holding his hand, telling him thanks, saying thank you. Thanks for being there. Thanks for doing this. And he passed. We had a great funeral for him. He had a sponsor. Now, my sponsor now, Johnny H. out in Long Beach, California, I get nervous every time I call him. The whole thing, are you supposed to feel comfortable calling your sponsor? If you get that after a certain amount of time, I don't know whether or not to be leery of that. I always feel edgy when I call my sponsor. Like, I always, like, kind of do a quick swallow. Like, you know, and if sometimes I even get relieved when I get the answering machine. It seems like sometimes I could be more honest with him, because I can dump the big stuff towards the end, because hopefully he's, like, erased it before that. I'm still an alcoholic. I'm definitely an alcoholic, but I need accountability as much as ever. So my disease doesn't run away from me. You guys, thank you so much for being here. Billy, thank you for having me down, and really appreciate it. Billy, when we were taking care of my sponsor last summer, my home group became very not very popular at all. And if you want to hear about that, I'll be happy to tell you all about that. It's within the realm of the traditions, and be happy to share with you about that. Well, anyway, it became not very popular, and my sponsor, I watched the legacy he had made in Alcoholics Anonymous just get completely trashed by gossip. Billy would send up the stuff from his garden. It was just amazing. I gained probably 25 pounds, caring for my sponsor, just sitting in that house, because people nonstop kept bringing stuff over to the house. Billy would drive up from down here just to come deliver some of the most amazing lemon cake I've ever had, ever, which was so good, which was so yummy. It makes a difference. I don't know what I'm going to do that makes a difference. I don't. But I'll tell you what, I'm excited to find out. And I'm as excited as ever to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is the most important thing to me today. So, thanks for having me here.